Kia ora koutou. Welcome to Clinical Snippets for August, and welcome my esteemed colleague Dave Mapleston. I'm hungry for some learning from you. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Morena tato. I'm Dave Mapleston, a GP, and I do provide in-house advice to the Health and Disability Commissioner. So some of my snippets are based on complaints I've had, and hopefully ways of keeping updated so we avoid putting ourselves in those positions.
Yeah. And well, let's throw ourselves into it. What have we got for August?
So the first one is related to a recent complaint I had from a woman who was not diagnosed with chickenpox, her child was not diagnosed with chickenpox, even though they had chickenpox while she was pregnant. And this resulted in her getting extremely ill when she did actually suffer chickenpox. So it was more around the diagnosis of the child, but it reinforced, I think, the need to be aware of what we should be doing if there is a suspected chickenpox or varus or zoster contact during pregnancy.
And so if a relative gets chickenpox during pregnancy, being really clear that this does impact pregnancy and people who are pregnant around that person need to be aware of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think from my point of view, I need to be aware of what actions I should take if confronted with a pregnant woman who says I may have been in contact with someone with chickenpox or I am in contact with someone with chickenpox.
Yeah.
And I think the importance of if there's any doubt about the diagnosis and say this patient's child, close contact, probably to err on the side of caution in some ways. So there's a really good algorithm. IMAC puts out a good algorithm for managing the situation. And I've got a link to that. So it's basically just runs through whether they've had a history of previous chickenpox or immunization, or the history of previous contact is uncertain, or they haven't. But essentially the process is basically try and make every effort to confirm the diagnosis and the suspected positive contact and assess the significance of exposure to the pregnant woman. So exposure or symptoms in the final 2 weeks of pregnancy should always be discussed with a specialist. And exposure to varicella or zoster for which zoster immune globulin is indicated for susceptible persons includes those living in the same household as a person with active chickenpox or herpes zoster, face-to-face contact with a case of chickenpox for at least 5 minutes, or close contact, such as touching or hugging, with a person with active zoster.
I think that's interesting. So I wouldn't necessarily have thought about herpes zoster, although you know that they're shedding the virus in a minimal way. I wouldn't have necessarily thought to think about shingles when dealing with somebody who's pregnant.
Yeah, I think, again, just having that lower threshold because of the risks to the mother and the fetus from chickenpox. But essentially, if the immune status of the pregnant patient is well known, they can say for certain they've had chickenpox previously, then they're not at risk. If the immune status is uncertain, you need to check the serology urgently. But noting that in people with no history or recall of the rash, about 70 to 90% are still found to be immune.
Yeah.
So we end up dealing with a minority of patients who are actually not immune, but immunosuppressed patients are susceptible to chickenpox at all times. So they're a subgroup that need to be treated differently and probably seeking specialist advice if you've got a pregnant patient on immunosuppressants who comes into contact with someone with chickenpox. Yeah. Or zoster.
Feels like there'd almost be an argument for adding varicella serology to the routine antenatal bloods.
I think the situation that this doctor was confronted with, I don't think it's that common.
Right.
But I don't know. You know, when we think that probably at least 70% of the population are immune anyway. It's probably not going to be that common a presentation. But for pregnant women who are immunosuppressed and those with negative varicella serology, IMAC recommends discussing the clinical circumstances with an infectious diseases physician before deciding on which course of action is best. But basically, the algorithm takes you through course of action depending on when the patient was exposed. So if the exposure was less than or equal to 10 days earlier, you need to give zostrammune globulin as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And if 7 to 10 days post-exposure, give oral acyclovir or valacyclovir if the mother is at risk of varicella pneumonitis. So that's an additional action for those at risk of pneumonitis. And that is those women in the second half of pregnancy, those with underlying lung disease, those that are immunocompromised or smokers.
Right.
And to access ZIG, you need to contact New Zealand Blood Transfusion and they need to give approval. So in the Canterbury Health Pathways, they provide you with a link to a specific request form and the details that are required, but that's not localised, doesn't seem to be localised for other areas at this stage.
It's available on the New Zealand Blood Transfusion site. I was looking for something else.
That's right.
And
I'll put a link to that as well. So so if the exposure is more than 10 days previously, then just closely observe for symptoms of varicella infection and treat promptly with acyclovir or valacyclovir if symptoms develop. But if the mother is at risk of pneumonitis, that's those groups we discussed before, and exposure occurred less than 14 days ago, so between 10 and 14 days, treat with acyclovir or valacyclovir rather than waiting. That's a little complex. That's why it's probably easier to access the algorithm if you're stuck in this situation.
Yeah.
And just if you're confronted with a pregnant woman who has developed symptoms of chickenpox, you need to treat urgently with antivirals and seek acute obstetric advice. Antiviral dose needs to be reduced in patients with renal impairment. And you need to counsel pregnant women exposed to varicella about the risks of congenital varicella syndrome. And that's highest in the first 20 weeks of pregnancy, but particularly between weeks 12 and 20. So about 0.4% in the first 12 weeks, but up to 2% in weeks 13 to 20. And that's a nasty syndrome. Mm. Babies are born with lesions and can have cognitive issues and other embryo toxic type effects.
And this applies to chickenpox or herpes zoster in the Whānau. So it might be something when we see the elderly person with their shingles, and we need to be counseling them about any pregnant people in their lives or their whānau.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
So something a bit lighter, which I've called, I take a green one at night. So it's just letting you know, and a lot of you probably all know this already, but there is a website called MedLook where you can search a medication and get a photo of the medication, a picture of the medication. And that's available for most commonly used drugs, including tablets, capsules, tubes, and even liquid preparations.
Yeah. Absinthe is green, isn't it? I think it's...
I don't know, that the self-medication rather than prescribed medication as a rule, but
it's such a common thing, isn't it, those for somebody to say, oh, I take it's blue and it's, you know, got a heart on the middle of it or something.
Yeah, or even if they say, look, my doctor gave me Fluclox, and you don't know what strength it was, you can look up, you just type in Fluclox-acillin, you've got a picture here which I'm showing of the various strength capsules and the colours of the capsules, so it would enable you to identify the precise medication the patient's taking. So that's MedLook, MedLook.org.
And it's New Zealand specific?
I don't think it is, but it does have, certainly has brand names that we use in New Zealand as well as generics, but it seems to have some brand names that we wouldn't use in New Zealand as well.
Okay, cool.
So getting back to the next topic, which is implicit bias. And I've brought this up.
I don't suffer from this, Dave. I know that.
Well, you can test yourself. but just issue 104 of the Maori Health Research Review includes findings from the recent New Zealand Health Survey, which show that more than one in three Maori, so 37.6%, experience racial discrimination over their lifetime. And this includes ethnically motivated personal attacks, as well as unfair treatment in healthcare, which is probably the most relevant thing in terms of what I'm talking about, employment or housing. And it's an increasing phenomenon. So the proportion of Māori experiencing racial discrimination in the past 12 months increased from 10.8% in the 2011-2012 survey to 13.8% in the 2021 survey, and was increased further when Māori women were analysed separately. Verbal abuse was the most common type of discrimination, but the discrimination itself was associated with higher rates of psychological distress, lower rates of good to excellent self-rated health, and higher rates of unmet need for primary health care. So I think it's just, again, something to keep in mind, and emphasise the importance, I think, of having a good understanding of the cultural background of this country. But the Ministry of Health has got some good resources as part of the Au Mai Te Rā Anti-Racism Kaupapa. And I've put a link in the snippets to a video and podcast series, which is worth looking at. Quite a time commitment, but again, from the point of view of satisfying your MOPS requirements, I think a useful resource to consider, just to raise awareness of this phenomenon.
And more than that, the something that is implicit. This isn't something that we are deliberately doing. I'm confident that none of us enter into start our day thinking that we're going to be biased against a particular ethnic group or the subculture within our practice. But unless we actually measure it and step back and think about it, then we're often not aware. I was talking to a Māori GP colleague whose own whānau experienced different access to primary care when they rang up and it was a Māori member of the family ring and a compared to a Pākehā member of the family ringing the same practice, which was really confronting.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting, and it is confronting. And in fact, some of these videos, one of the videos is quite confronting in that they say, look, it shouldn't be called implicit bias or unconscious bias, it should be called racism.
Yes.
So, you know, all sorts of issues to consider. But, I think, you know, there are none of us that go out deliberately to be racist, but you might want to consider taking the look at the Harvard University Implicit Association Test, which I've put a link to in the snippets. And that assesses for unconscious bias, unconscious or implicit preference on a number of issues. You can choose which questionnaires you take or don't take, but they include things like skin tone, race, although it's because it's an American test, it's not Māori specific, but age and weight. And you might be interested in, you know, whether you've got subconscious or implicit ageism, for example, in addition to the looking at the racial bias.
Yeah. I've done those, and I think it's worthwhile repeating it as well. You know, maybe making, as you say, part of your MOPS self-assessment is to do an implicit bias test once a year. It doesn't take too long. And I think one of the things with this is that your implicit biases can sort of change over time as well. Yeah, definitely. Thanks for that. I've just had my conversation with my colleague, so I might add that to one of my goals.
Excellent.
My college things, yes.
Well, I've just had mine, and I think I'm to read a book on something entitled something about white supremacy, which is meant to be very good insight into this whole concept of unconscious bias and implicit bias.
I've got a list of books for you, actually. Which we can, the white fragility was, I think, really meaningful, and that term seems, again, is quite confronting, but it's actually it's really interesting. And I see now my fragility around a range of things that I'm, we should probably talk about that offline, maybe.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the conversations that we're talking about are the annual conversation that the College of GPs have embedded into our maintenance of professional standards process for GPs. And yeah, really useful, just step back and reflect on your goals and what you've achieved and what you want to achieve in the next year. So
I think interesting you say about repeating those implicit bias tests too, because I did, I did one 8 years ago on whether I was ageist or not, and repeated that recently. And I've actually become less biased against old people over the 8 years, strangely enough.
I wonder if that applies to the obesity as well. I'll do that.
Okay, next one up is a reminder from the June edition of Prescriber Update related to a rare but potentially devastating effect of ocular NSAIDs, like your Voltaren eye drops, which I do see prescribed not infrequently in medical GP notes that I review. So it is initiated in primary care, but it's a condition which sounds terrible called corneal melting. So the condition can be caused by various conditions, including eye infections, sterile inflammation, has an association with rheumatoid arthritis, and surgical or chemical injury to the cornea. But more recently, the use of ocular NSAIDs has been linked to the condition, but the mechanism as to why it causes the condition is unknown. So there's some situations that will increase the risk for NSAID-induced corneal melting, which include frequent application or prolonged treatment with topical NSAIDs, concomitant use of steroids, and concomitant conditions such as acute eye infections, rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, or ocular surface disease. And I guess given we're likely to be using it in a patient with some sort of ocular inflammation, because that's why we use it, that's potentially an at-risk situation. So the warning just says, consider the possibility of corneal melting in patients using ocular NSAIDs who complain of blurred or distorted vision, worsening eye pain, eye irritation, and hypersensitivity or ocular discharge. Again, you know, that's why we're treating them in the first place. So it does make it a little difficult. But to check these patients for corneal damage, so to do your have a look and put some fluorescein in. And if they do experience those symptoms or signs, possibly consistent with corneal melting, early diagnosis and treatment are critical to prevent further corneal damage. So recommendation is to seek urgent specialist advice. And they should obviously stop the ocular NSAID immediately.
I'm stunned by that phrase, corneal melting. It sounds like a horror movie. And I don't think I have ever prescribed an ocular NSAID without the explicit advice of an ophthalmologist. And fortunately for me in Oportiki, then the ophthalmologists have a system which is they're available, their on-call person is available and rapidly available for us to make assessments. We make joint assessments of patients. Haven't actually done that by telehealth yet, but I can see that that's coming in the not too distant future. But I would, is it reasonable for us to involve an ophthalmologist in making a decision to prescribe an NSAID?
Well, this is a rare complication, but it's such a devastating one that maybe it's worth considering.
I remember, and the other thing is, is the concomitant use of corticosteroids, is that about oral corticosteroids?
And that was topical.
Topical corticosteroids, yeah. As I remember, an undergraduate lecture from an ophthalmologist who was supposed to last for an hour, and he basically just put up a slide saying, never put steroids in the eye, and then said we could all go and have a cup of coffee. Because that was the one lesson that he wanted us to take away, and it didn't really matter what else he was going to say. So it was a great extra cup of coffee as a medical student. Yeah. But that lesson has really stuck in my mind. I have prescribed them, but only with the direct input from an ophthalmologist.
Yeah. And I'm always ultra cautious with eyes. Anything with eyes. I had a bad experience as a house officer. I did an eye run. And I saw a patient in ED who'd been in a car accident, been through windscreen, and had injured their eyes, and I was trying to get what I thought was a foreign body out of the eye until I realized it was actually the iris prolapsing through a corneal laceration. So
this is an X-rated podcast nowadays.
Anyway, you learn from your errors. That's and I didn't do any damage, I don't think, because I didn't actually pull the whole iris out, but yeah. It's just not
I'm sure it's not X-rated, it's R18 now, isn't it? Yeah.
If you're not highly experienced in what you're in, or have, you know, be cautious.
I would like you to be quiet about your eye experiences now and move on to the next.
Many years ago. Interesting, the next one is based on a couple of complaints I've looked at in the last month. So just coincidentally, two complaints around delayed diagnosis of nasopharyngeal cancer. So I just thought I'd put some hints up to try and avoid putting oneself in that same position. So it is a rare cancer. It's an undifferentiated form of squamous cell carcinoma, quite uncommon in European populations, about one case per 100,000, but up to 25 to 50 cases per 100,000 in southern China. Mm. So male preponderance, and the risk factors are genetics, susceptibility, which you won't know about generally, previous EBV infection. Again, that's so common.
Ubiquitous.
And environmental factors such as smoking, alcohol, and nitrosamine-containing foods. The presenting symptoms are variable, but around 80% of patients will have nasal symptoms. And the critical thing is unilateral symptoms. Yeah. So unilateral nasal obstruction, epistaxis, post-nasal drip, hyponasal speech, or cacosmia. And cacosmia is just what it sounds like, which is an unpleasant smell, distorted, unpleasant smell. About 50% of patients will have ear symptoms, mostly secondary to eustachian tube obstruction by the tumor. And again, you know, it's unilateral symptoms. So such as conductive hearing loss, middle ear effusion, or oral fullness. And the red flag they say here is that adult with unilateral middle ear effusion requires visualization of the nasopharynx to exclude neoplasm. Mm. So I presume that would be, you know, a patient who you've treated their acute middle ear effusion as per normal, but it hasn't gone away or it keeps recurring. Can have neurological symptoms with more advanced disease, so cranial nerve palsy in about 20% of patients as a presenting symptom, and it's most commonly cranial nerve 6, if you remember that, that's the abducens nerve, and you get a lateral rectus palsy, so horizontal diplopia when looking to the affected side.
I put myself to sleep by reciting the distribution of the cranial nerves. They've sort of caught sight of it. I'm just joking. I listened to podcasts and said, which is apparently what people, somebody approached me the other day and said they listen to this podcast and it puts them to sleep every night.
God. Well, I think I'm probably the same. I had an absolute mental block on two parts of anatomy during my training. One was the cranial nerves and one was the bones of the foot. And no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't remember which went where.
So long as you're in the middle, then you're fine.
But nodal involvement is the other presenting feature, a large cervical lymph node, and usually the apex of the posterior triangle and upper jugular are most commonly involved. Supraclavicular nodes are the last to be involved and are a sign of advanced disease. So just, I think if you've got a patient out there that you've been managing for several months with unilateral nasal or ear signs in that older age group, just keep in the back of your mind, could it be a nasopharyngeal carcinoma brewing?
Do those things fit into the high suspicion of cancer in criteria in the referrals that we use, do you know?
I don't think there are any specific for NPC for nasopharyngeal cancer, but it would be, there would be some red flags under the neck mass sign, for example.
I think you just have to state, you know, I'm dealing with this person. They've got a unilateral middle ear infusion, which I can't explain. They've got unilateral nasal signs. I have a suspicion that they have a cancer. because the risk is with the state of the health system as it is in New Zealand, that those referrals get rejected for, you know, more information is required, or, you know, the and the patient gets sort of bounced around a little bit.
Absolutely.
So being explicit when you have a suspicion of cancer is, I think, really, really important.
And I think we've lost the skill to visualize the nasopharynx. I know when I bought my practice, I inherited mirrors and one of those, mirrors on, like dental mirrors, and also one of those things you put on your head, a round mirror with a hole in the middle that reflected the light. And I used to actually try and look at the nasopharynx or adenoids using those in my first couple of years in practice, but I certainly haven't done that for many, many years. And I think if you'd want to be sure you're not dealing with a nasopharyngeal cancer in this situation.
It won't be too long before there's an MRI scanner in a suitcase in every practice, Dave.
Yeah, well, I wonder if you get your old ultrasound probe out and push it around the area. That's anyway, that's NPC. Number six, just an update on funded meningococcal vaccine eligibility. So I thought this was, if we get an ACT national government coming in, which is quite likely, there are going to be a lot more young people in prisons and facilities.
We have to mark it as R18 and a politically required.
Sorry. anyway, people, the eligibility has been extended to people aged between 13 and 25 who are in correctional facilities, as well as those in first year living in boarding school hostels, tertiary education halls of residence, and military barracks. So correctional facilities have been added to the list of eligible facilities. And just to note,
I interrupted you before, but that's why you think that National and ACT are going to increase the need for this.
Well, I think they've stated their policy of imprisoning, 17-year-olds upwards, haven't they? Whatever.
Yeah.
Because it's so efficacious.
Yeah. Okay.
At stopping recidivists. Anyway, just a reminder to you, there's a free catch-up program available until 28th of February 2024 for all people aged 13 to 25 currently living in those areas. Otherwise, after February, I think it is only people entering those facilities, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So after February, when you enter the correctional facility, then that's the time that you'll be offered by corrections medical time. They'll be offering you the meningococcal. But at the moment, it's for everybody who's in a boarding school.
In their first year of living in those various facilities. Next, family history of colorectal cancer screening update. So Te Whatu Ora have released updated guidelines on surveillance recommendations for individuals with a family history of colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And they're really not particularly a change other than incorporating now the National Bowel Screening Program results. So essentially category one, which is slightly above average risk of colorectal cancer, and that's one first degree relative diagnosed at or over the age of 55 years, it's basically just strongly advising individuals to participate in the National Bowel Screening Program when they become eligible. Mm. No other recommendation apart from healthy lifestyle choices and reporting symptoms.
Yeah.
Category two, moderately increased risk, which is one first degree relative diagnosed under 55 years, or two first degree relatives on the same side of the family diagnosed with colorectal cancer at any age, and no additional high-risk factors which put them into category three.
Mm-hmm.
And they are advised colonoscopy every 5 years from age 50 or from an age 10 years before the earliest age which the colorectal cancer was diagnosed in the family or whānau member, whichever comes first.
Yeah.
And provided they've had a high-quality colonoscopy within the previous 5 years, they then participate in the National Bowel Screening Program from the age of 60 years. So this includes Māori who are eligible to join the bowel screening program at age 50, but they will maintain the colonoscopic surveillance until they're 60. So even though they're eligible for the program at 50, you keep the the formal surveillance going until their age of 60.
Right. Okay.
So it's just distinguishing that even though they're eligible for the ballot screening program, you don't hand them over at 50. You don't hand them over to the ballot screening program at 50. You wait until they're 60.
Yeah.
Is that's quite clear?
Yeah, I think so. So the I've got two relatives who got colorectal cancer diagnosed in their 70s. So that puts me in the high risk category. They're both on the same side of the family.
Yeah.
So it puts me in the high risk thing. I'm 45 and Māori, I'll have a high quality colonoscopy when I'm 50.
Yep. You have another one at 55.
One at 55, and then hand over to potentially another one at 60, and then hand over to the bowel screening program at that point.
That's right. Yeah. And that's whether you're Māori or non-Māori, even though if you're Māori, you're actually eligible for the bowel screening program at age of 50.
Yeah, okay.
And category three is a potentially high risk, and that's got it's extremely detailed in terms of number of polyps and type of polyps and a whole lot of other factors. So I haven't detailed those here, but I've put a link to the actual guidance.
Yeah.
And those patients are generally referred to the New Zealand Familial GI Cancer Service or some other genetic service for an accurate risk assessment and then surveillance as advised by the relevant agency or their surgeon.
But without a colonoscopy, we're not going to be able to make the diagnosis of category three patients.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yep. And just to round things off, something interesting and I think probably increasing in utility, particularly in rural practice. So issue 218 of the GP Research Review looked at a randomized trial in Australia comparing ultrasonography or radiography for suspected pediatric distal forearm fractures. So it was children and adolescents aged 5 to 15 with an isolated distal forearm injury without visible deformity, and they underwent either ultrasonography or radiography. And the outcome was there was no clinically significant fractures missed on ultrasound, and there was no difference between the two groups in functional outcome after 4 weeks. And the reviewer noted the potential for use of POCUS for this purpose, particularly in rural general practice. So again, another thing that the good old increasingly affordable and mobile ultrasound devices can be used for.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if I mentioned, I did the POCUS GP for the heart course that they'd run in Waikato a few weeks ago, and absolutely fascinating. And so much A, to learn, but also the facility of this, it is going to get easier and easier. And not a portable MRI scanner in a suitcase, but we're slowly getting there. And a modality, a skill, I think, that is becoming easier to learn as well as to apply in general practice. So that's awesome, Dave. Thank you. So you've reminded us about varicella in pregnancy. And I think one of my takeaways from that is particularly around herpes zoster as well as chickenpox exposure. Just a reminder, and probably about those people who are diagnosed with zoster, to be aware of the pregnant people within the whānau. I loved the MedLook website. I'll have a look around there, and because again, such a common question for me to be trying to answer. What are the pills that you're taking? And they're just the blue ones, doctor. We talked about implicit bias, and you've given us access to some tools there, both the video series and podcasts around Aumai Te Rā, anti-racism, kaupapa, which I think is awesome, as well as the Harvard Implicit Bias Association test. We've strayed into eye-popping horror with non-NSAIDs in the melting corneas, and nasopharyngeal cancer reminder, the meningococcal disease, and we sort of roved into political incorrectness or perhaps correctness. I don't know. October will tell. And then a reminder about family history of colorectal cancer and just little sort of tease, really, or encourage us to sort of think about learning new things and focus and it's the increasing use of it. So that's awesome, Dave. Thank you so much. Just to remind people that you can, after listening to the podcast, you can upload into your, if you're in the New Zealand and your GP, you can upload into your Te Whanake website a reflection on the podcast and get some extra points for that. I think this is an excellent way of keeping yourself up to date with what's happening in New Zealand general practice. And I know it's, I just value these conversations so much, Dave. It really, really helps. So thanks for all of the work you put in. And we'll see you again next month, hopefully.
My pleasure. Kia ora.
Kia ora. Why is that not stopping? There we go.